Good evening. My name's Carl. I'm an alcoholic.
Carl.
Whenever I get introduced as Carl from Covina, I think I either have to change my name or move. One of the two. I'm going to only say this because it's a polite thing to do, and thank you, Mark, for having me come up here. There was a sign back about 10 miles before Palmdale that said, "You've now reached any length, and you have 20 more miles to go." But you know what? For decades, I've made drives like this in Alcoholics Anonymous, and sometimes you make that drive and you find three people, and two of them don't want to be there. And that's disappointing to do that, but when you make this drive and then you find an enthusiastic, fun, welcoming, recovery-centered group with a big greeting line and everybody says hello, it is absolutely my privilege to participate in that type of Alcoholics Anonymous. Because I just love to participate in a meeting. I don't think that, you know, when you show up and nobody wants to be there, some people think, well, you're supposed to be there to convince them of something. That's not AA, going to convince somebody to get excited about Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm just the next bozo on the bus that is here to tell his story and try to stay sober himself. So anyway, the most important thing I can tell you about myself is that I'm an alcoholic. There's a lot of things that I really care about in this world. There are things that I think are important. There are things that I spend a lot of time paying attention to. There are things that I have passion for. But there's nothing more important than the fact that I'm an alcoholic. And the reason that I believe I'm an alcoholic is really very simple. The reason I believe I'm an alcoholic is because I've got a really strange relationship with alcohol. That's why I'm an alcoholic. No other reason. And the strange relationship that I have with alcohol takes on a few forms. The first part of this strange relationship that I have with alcohol happens when I drink it. Very strange thing happens when I drink booze. The book calls it an allergic reaction. And the book says the symptom of this alert, she's bringing up the winning tickets right now. And by the way, your 10-minute speaker was wonderful. And she's going to bring my winning ticket up here. The book says the symptom of this allergic reaction that I get when I drink alcohol is something called the phenomenon of craving. And the best way that I can describe this thing that the book calls the phenomenon of craving in my life is that it seems like whenever I drink booze, the more booze I drink, the thirstier I get. It's really strange. It does not happen with anything else that I drink. An example of that, the group was kind enough to give me this bottle of water. And over the next 45 minutes to 8 hours that I'm talking with you, I drove for 2 hours, for God's sake. Over the next 45 minutes that I'm going to be talking with you, I will probably drink half this bottle of water, and I'll probably take it with me and finish it on the way home. But I can absolutely guarantee you that once I finish this bottle of water, I am not going to go buy a case of water and lock myself in a cheap motel room in El Monte. There's no chance that I'm going to be texting Mark, "Dude, I need another case, man, I need another case. I'll turn the pink slip in my car over, man, dude, come on." It's not going to happen. But if that was the only thing that made me alcoholic, this bizarre physical reaction, this bizarre unquenchable thirst that happens once I drink, if that was the sum total of my relationship with alcohol that was causing problems, well then, just say no would have wiped out alcoholism. Many of you are old enough to remember we had a first lady that came out with this big campaign, "Just Say No." If that would have worked, I would have, and I imagine you would have gone, "Oh, ha, ha, no," and just and just gone on and lived a happy, successful life just saying no. But I've got this other really strange component of my relationship with alcohol. And what's really strange about this part of my relationship with alcohol is that this happens when I'm not drinking. If you're new or fairly new, I'm going to say it again with even more emphasis. This deadly component of my relationship with alcohol happens when I'm not drinking. Our book calls this the mental obsession. They also refer to it as the strange mental blank spot, and they drive it even further home when they call it the thought process that precedes the first drink. And the best way that I can describe this thing that the book calls the mental obsession in my life is it seems like no matter how much pain and suffering the last drunk caused, I seem to have a mind that will always paint a picture that makes it okay for me to take another drink. I seem to have a mind that will rationalize and justify my walk back to the next drink at all cost. So therefore, because of these two components of my relationship with alcohol, number one, I cannot drink successfully because this thing called the craving, right? This unquenchable thirst, this loss of control once I drink. So I cannot drink successfully. But at the very same time, because of this thing called the mental obsession, I cannot not drink successfully. I'm damned if I do, and I'm damned if I don't. It's the ultimate catch-22 we call alcoholism. Not an alcohol problem, alcoholism. An alcohol problem is solved by stopping drinking. Alcoholism is this strange, strange, weird thing that I assume you have, because otherwise you wouldn't be here tonight. You'd be at home not drinking. And apparently I have it, because if I didn't have it, I would not have driven up here. I've got a very bad case of it. I'm going to harp on that physical feature just a little bit more, because bar none, that's the one thing we have in common. Because there's a lot of things we don't have in common, really. You know, if you listen to people when they tell their stories, we have all sorts of things that are different. That's because Alcoholics Anonymous is a huge, wide cross-section of society. Every single race, creed, color, religion, every single social and economic background, every single culture, we're all here. In fact, we're such a wide cross-section of society that right here in this meeting, it's very possible that we have a bank president, a bank teller, and a bank robber, all right here in this room right now. So our stories are very different because of where we came from. But on top of that, we drink differently than each other. We really do. If you listen closely when people tell their stories in meetings, I think you'll agree we drink differently than each other. To illustrate that, if you're new, this would never happen in an AA meeting, but just to illustrate what I'm talking about, let's imagine right through those back doors and right up this main aisle, we brought in a giant cart, wheeled it right in there, and on that cart, we got all the kinds of booze we all love. If you're some sort of expensive top-shelf drinker, we got it for you. Remy Martin, Cavassier, fine, fine, fine. But if you're a bottom-shelf drinker, we got that too. Mad Dog 2020. I got respect for you guys. I really do. And everything in between. And we brought it right in here, and we all took a good 4 or 5 stiff drinks. Real drinks. No umbrellas in there. No mixer. A good 4 or 5 stiff drinks. We'd all be acting very differently. Right? Over in this corner, we'd have the good time crowd. Ah, fun, fun, fun. Woo! Drink, drink, drink. Talk, talk, talk. Drink, drink, drink. Talk, talk, talk. Drink, drink, drink. Party, party, party. Talk, talk, talk. If we had a little methamphetamine, we talked a little faster. Talk, 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 talk. But we're having a good time in this corner. Over in that corner, we'd have the criers. You know them, they get a little drunk, like, over in that corner, we'd have the fighters, right? Get drunk, gotta fight, fight, fight. Over in this corner, a bunch of us would be naked. I personally would be visiting the other three corners trying to find a couple of friends to come over here with me. Just the way I get. So our stories are very different based upon which corner we're drinking in. In the good time corner, you get a lot of DUIs. You're out of the bars. You got to get to the next bar. It's always happening in the next bar. After hours, whose house are we going to? Let's go. Woo! We're out there on the road, right? So we get arrested a lot. Over in the crying corner, they don't get arrested. They don't even leave the damn house. Maybe they get 5150'd every once in a while, right? But they, you know. So our stories are very different based upon which corner we're drinking in. But no matter which corner we're drinking in, there's one thing we would all be doing. We would all be back at that cart for another drink. It was really important for me to understand that when I was new in Alcoholics Anonymous, when they said, listen for the similarities rather than the differences. Because if I listen to what kind of family did you come from, where did you grow up, what age group are you, what sexual orientation are you, if I listen to all of that, I don't know, do I identify maybe Maybe not. But if I listen to what happens to you when you drink, and then almost more importantly, what happens to you when on your own you try to stop drinking, I can identify with anybody in Alcoholics Anonymous. You're me, I'm you. I set this relationship up with alcohol that I just described to you right from the get-go when I first started drinking. I started drinking very late compared to most people in AA. I was 11. It's late. I was born in Helena, Montana. My father packed our whole family up when I was 4 years old, moved it to the island of Borneo in Southeast Asia. That's where I grew up as a child. I came back to the United States at 10 years old and moved to Seattle. And at 11, I took a drink. Wasn't trying to escape from anything. I didn't come from an alcoholic home. I took a drink because my best friend Dave said, my dad's having a big party next week. He bought a couple of cases of whiskey and vodka. We could steal a bottle. He probably wouldn't even notice. And I said, this is a great idea. And we stole a bottle, and my life changed. Everything changed because I became absolutely obsessed with that, and I had that physical reaction to alcohol right from the get-go. By the time I'm 14 there in Seattle, I'm the neighborhood drunk. I'm the neighborhood pot dealer. My father was a neighborhood Lutheran minister. My vocabulary at 14 was, whoa, wow, right? My parents, like, what happened to our son? My parents, really good people, really solid people. And they tried to help, but they always blame my problems on people, place, and things. Get them away from that group of kids he's hanging out with. We're taking them out of the public school, putting them into private schools. They did all of the above. You see, I'm an alcoholic. My problems are not based upon people, place, and things. My problems are based upon my physical and mental, and if I get around to a spiritual relationship with alcohol. See, if you change the people, place, and things in somebody's life like mine, all that happens is I'm drunk with different people in different places, ruining different things. That's all that happens. By the time I was 18, I barely scraped out of the public school system there in Seattle. And after getting kicked out of the private school system, my parents decided that Seattle was the problem. Get them out of Seattle. Things get better. They sent me 300 miles away to Washington State University. I spent 3 years at that school, and I got about 10 credits. At any given time, my grade point average matched my blood alcohol content, about a 0.25. I did nothing at that school. I'm going to skip over a little piece here. At 23, what I'm about to tell you should concern you greatly, but I joined the Navy, and on my way into the Navy, I passed a potential test that qualified me to become a nuclear engineer. That should concern you that the United States Navy would have any type of system in place that even maybe, possibly, or even remotely would allow somebody like me near anything nuclear. However, they made me take another test when I showed up at that base of a boot camp, and I could not pass that particular test. That test is called a urinalysis test, is what it's called. I never knew how to study for those things. Should have been kicked out. Series of events allowed me to stay in. They took away the 2-year nuclear school. They sent me directly out to the fleet. Now I'm out in the middle of the Pacific Ocean on a Spruance-class destroyer hunting Russian submarines, and I got to tell you, while the ship was out at sea, I did well. I started to understand what it meant to serve my country. I started to understand the camaraderie of being in the military. By God, I was learning a trade that could have held me till today if I would have wanted to. However, that ship would always pull into a port. And when that ship would pull into a port, I'd leave that ship and I'd take a drink. And at this point in my life, I'm 23, I'm 24, I'm 25 years old. And at this point in my life, when I take a drink, I would always trigger off a minimum of 2 days, sometimes a 3-day, and every once in a while, a 4-day drunk. And I got to tell you, when I'm in the middle of a 4-day drunk, but the ship is only in port for 2 days, we've got a little math problem. It's a very strange feeling coming out of one of these 4-day drunks, finding myself on a large pier at 6 a.m. in the morning in a foreign country. And I'm looking up and down that pier going, there was a destroyer here the other day. Navy gets very angry at that behavior. I've been in the Navy about 2 years at this point, and I came to in a cheap hotel room in downtown San Diego, and you know that nightmare. Oh, my God, what day is it? What day? Oh, no, it's Monday. I started drinking on Thursday. No! Oh, is the ship even here? And I got in my car, and you know the old story. My car is dying of alcoholism right along with me. I'm trying to get back to the base. And one of the tools of living I got at this point is I would always save a pint underneath my car seat for the end of the drunk, because I always knew it's going to be a while till when I get back to the ship, it's going to be a while till I get a drink. So I'm trying to get that pint in me, and I'm racing as fast as I can. And I lost control of the car right in front of the Navy base and flipped the car off this median and boom, right through this guard shack where a Marine stands duty. And as I stand before you today, I am so very grateful that United States Marines are in tip-top physical shape. This young man did a quick somersault out of that guard shack. He was back up, weapon drawn. God, I hated mornings like this. I really did. You know, sirens going off, everybody screaming and yelling, running in different directions. They're all pointing at me like this is my fault. And I'm climbing out of the car wondering, you know, I got some questions too. What the hell happened here? I really hated mornings like that. Stage two of mornings that I really hated was about an hour later, I find myself in a hospital bed and I'm handcuffed to the hospital bed. I really hated mornings like that. That morning, of course, my Navy superiors are reading new charges on me. This is nothing significant in my life. New charges are just what happens in a guy's life like mine about every 90 days if you're living the way I'm living. But the most significant thing that happened that morning is the Navy doctors prescribed this stuff called antabuse for me. I was now under order to show up at sick bay every single morning before quarters. I'd have to sit in a chair with my hands gripped to the side of the chair. I was not allowed to lift my hands. I had to stick my tongue out. And the hospital coroner would put this little white pill on my tongue and make me sit there for a half an hour to make sure that antabuse actually got in my system. Over the next 7 to 10 days, I started to experience the most cunning, baffling, and powerful side of this thing we call alcoholism, and that is I had no alcohol in my system, but I'm slowly going insane. Throughout my life, people that loved me, cared about me, or who had authority over me would take alcohol away from me. This was not the first time alcohol had been taken away from me. There had been catastrophic events that when I was a teenager in my early 20s where people would intervene and they would take alcohol away from me. And I'd always be sent to well-meaning, highly educated people, some sort of therapist, psychologist, psychiatrist, or a pastor. And these well-meaning, highly educated people in these one-on-one appointments would always, you know, we'd be there one-on-one in an office, and they'd have some sort of report in front of them. And it always went some version of this. What's the matter with you? Why do you drink this way? If I would have had the vocabulary that you guys have given me here in Alcoholics Anonymous over the last 38 years, I would have responded to these well-meaning people. I would have said, I see that you're shocked by my drinking. I am too sometimes. But then I would have followed it up with this. But if you knew what I felt like when I wasn't drinking, you wouldn't be asking me why I drink. There's only one thing worse than the price I'm paying for my drinking, and that's the way that I feel when I'm not drinking. But I didn't know how to verbalize that to them or myself. I lasted about 10 days on this antabuse, and I went AWOL from my ship. Locked myself in that little hotel room in San Diego, same one I came to in a few months before. Locked myself in that hotel room. It's the Plaza Hotel, 4th and Broadway. It's right across from the U.S. Grant. It's in the 80s, it was about $13 a night. They've upgraded it. I checked right around COVID. It was $19 a night. They've upgraded it. Maybe with recent inflation, it might be $22 a night now. I'm not really sure. But before you go there, check the Yelp reviews. But I locked myself in this little hotel room, and I had a bottle of vodka and a shot glass on a rickety little end table. And as I stared at that bottle of vodka, I remembered that the Navy doctors had given me a very stern warning about drinking on top of antabuse when they prescribed it for me. They had told me, son, you need to understand that if you drink on top of this antabuse, you're going to get one of two reactions. One reaction is you will get violently ill. The other reaction, son, is you might die. I remember looking at that bottle and I thought, well, I wonder which reaction I'm going to get. So I took one shot and nothing happened. Authority had lied to me again as far as I was concerned. I waited about 2 minutes just to make sure and I took another shot. All of a sudden, I felt tingly in the face, so I looked in this cracked little mirror that was in this hotel room, and I was bright red, blotchy and purple in places. Took another shot. All of a sudden, I could feel my heart going boom, boom, boom. Looked at my shirt. I was drenched in sweat, and all of a sudden, like, hyperventilating. We're doing all right so far. There's something the matter with you guys if you think this is funny. So I took another shot, and up it came. My second sponsor was a man named Eddie Cochran. His sobriety date was December 2nd, 1951. He was one of the pioneers of Southern California Alcoholics Anonymous. He called the next thing that happened to me projectile regurgitation. This is a new level of puking I am unfamiliar with. It literally was like, ah! Like, kind of like in The Exorcist, right? When Linda Blair just spraying it across the room. Thank God the Plaza Hotel is the type of hotel room where the toilet is in the same room with the bed. Might be a design feature, I believe. Maybe to make convicts feel more at home upon release. I'm not really sure. But I found the magic of drinking on top of van abuse, and that is if you hang in there. That's a very important feature. You cannot half measure it if you're going to drink on top of van abuse. In fact, if you're going to drink on top of van abuse, you might need to reach down deep inside yourself for a level of commitment you might not even know you have. But I found that if I kept drinking and kept puking and kept drinking and kept puking for about an hour to an hour and a half, enough of the van abuse would kick out of my system and I would quit throwing up and I would just be left with a red face, hyperventilating and sweating, and I'm all right with that. So I drank on top of van abuse the last 7 months of my drinking. The only words to describe this are desperation drinking. My second and my last drunk, I was left for dead in a pool of blood in a motel parking lot. And next thing I knew, I came to and I'm on an operating table and they're doing reconstructive surgery on my face. My last night of drinking, I'm being let out of the San Diego jail. I'm being transferred from the civilian authorities over to the military authorities. Long process. Handcuffs are extra tight. Neck muscles are not working well that morning. Finally, they tried to bring me back to my ship, and as we approached the quarter deck, the officer deck put his arm up and said, wrong answer. Orders have already been processed on this loser last night. He is not to cross the quarter deck of this ship. The orders are 90 days in the brig, bad conduct discharge, or, then he got this sour look on his face when he said the next thing, or it says here he can go to treatment. When they said treatment, I went, It wasn't because I thought treatment was a good idea. I didn't even know really what it was. I'd heard of treatment. We always hear of stuff like that when we're out there drinking. But this is the way I would have heard about treatment. I could be in a bar or a crack house. And somebody says, hey, anybody seen Tracy lately? And somebody say, Tracy got arrested. He went to treatment. We'd all go, That was it. Nobody did any... Hey, we should do some follow-up questions. We should see what he's up to, see how he's doing. Maybe he can help us. None of that, just, right? But that morning when they said, or treatment, the reason it piqued my interest was because I was in handcuffs, and I had experience with this. Whenever you're in handcuffs, I knew that I was going to be seeing a judge fairly soon. I thought that treatment thing might help me with that appointment with the judge. But I now know that it wouldn't have mattered what I was thinking or feeling that morning because I was in handcuffs. And whenever you're in handcuffs, they never turn to you and say, so what's your opinion on what we're going to do next? Right? When you're in handcuffs, you go where they say. And they took me up to a military treatment center. And when the doors were locked behind me, that's when they took the handcuffs off me. I got to tell you that as far as I'm concerned, in the late 1980s, early 1990s, the United States Navy had one of the finest treatment centers in the world. It's not because they had some new method of detox. It's not because they did any kind of wonderful counseling. I'm sure that was all done very well and professionally. The reason I believe they were so brilliant is 4 to 5 nights a week, about 4 or 5 white vans would pull up to those barracks. 6 to 8 of us would be put into each one of those vans. Those vans would leave the Navy base and go out in town, and they would take us to open meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. If this were in San Diego in the 80s, this would be exactly the type of meeting they would bring us to, and we'd be sitting right along the back. And I'm so very grateful that Alcoholics Anonymous allows outside agencies to refer potential alcoholics to open meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. So I had the privilege of sitting in these rooms 4 to 5 nights a week with the other military men and women, and we got to watch Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't know there's a huge difference between watching Alcoholics Anonymous and actually doing Alcoholics Anonymous, but this is what happened because I had the privilege of sitting in the back watching Alcoholics Anonymous. First thing I noticed, once again, I'm in a situation where alcohol has been taken away from me. Throughout my life, every other time, I'd always been put into these one-on-one appointments with these well-meaning, highly educated people that wanted to talk to me about me. They always said, what is this, son? Why do you do this? What happened to you? Blah, blah, blah. Always wanted to talk to me about me. Now I'm in another situation. Alcohol has been taken away from me, and I'm in here with you, and you guys do not want to talk to me about me. You guys seem to only want to talk about yourselves. That's all. Well, that's what you would do. You would go. They would go on and on and on about themselves, like I'm doing tonight. Right? When Mark sent me a text about 6 months ago, you want to come up to Lancaster and talk about yourself for 45 minutes? I said, yes, I do. Thought it was a great idea till I got on the drive. If you get nervous, I still get very nervous doing this. If you get nervous, I know why you do. It's because we judge you. You're going to be out at Denny's. You're going to be out at Denny's talking about what we both said, and you like this, you didn't like that, and I disagree with this, and you know. Blah, blah, blah. So if you're new and that makes you nervous, we get it. Here's the trick. Go practice telling your story in the mental institution. They don't judge you. They don't. And then while you're practicing telling your story in the mental institution, if at a certain point in your story, a guy on the couch goes, oh, that part's great, man, save that. Because if they like it in the mental institution, we're going to love it here in Alcoholics Anonymous. Kidding, not kidding. It's called H&I if you're new. It's one of the most valuable things you can do here in Alcoholics Anonymous. The other thing that I noticed, I believed you drank like me because the way you seemed to tell your stories, you had me convinced, just like any group is supposed to. I believed you drank like me, and I believed you were sober. But this is what baffled me. You guys seem to be happy about being sober. I have never seen that. This is what sober was to me before. Hey, Carl, why aren't you drinking? I can't! They're on me again. I can't. That was sobriety. But you guys seem to, like, celebrate it. You were comfortable with it. You had this sobriety date that would roll right off your tongue like your children's birthday. You seemed to value that sobriety date. And I noticed that in my first few meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. It was huge to me. It was huge. So after 45 days, they're going to let me out of that military treatment center. That's just what the orders were. And my car was brought into an impound lot. I'd been arrested in a vehicle the night before, and they brought it to the impound lot on that part of that Navy base where the treatment center was. And I was let out of that military treatment center with 45 days of sobriety. And I'm in that car, and I'm leaving that base. It's a Friday afternoon, and I have my orders sitting in front of me. And my orders said that I do not need to be back to my ship till Monday. In chapter 5, when it was read, it says, we stood at the turning point. I have to tell you, in my 38 years of sobriety, I've stood at the turning point many times under many, many conditions. What I mean by turning point is when you look back at your life, there's certain points where you realize if I would have turned right, my life would have gone that way, but I turned left and my life went that way. Good or bad, you realize there was this point, this moment. And the very first one turning point that I faced was as I was pulling off that base and those orders said I didn't need to be back to my ship till Monday. One voice was saying, Carl, you can head south on the 15 and the 163 and you can drop right back downtown San Diego and be right back at the Plaza Hotel in 20 minutes and pick up right where you left off. But there was another voice that I swear came from you guys. There's another voice that said, but Carl, if you turn left, there's that meeting place that they took you to a couple of times, and you remember exactly where it is because it's just about 4 blocks from a bar you used to drink in. And the people in that meeting said that they had been at an earlier meeting earlier that day at the same location. And somebody else made mention that they were at a late night meeting at that same location. I didn't understand what, it was actually an Alano club of sorts. I didn't understand that. All I knew is that if I turn left and I know where it's at, maybe I can go there and I'll be safe and maybe a meeting will be started. And it was the North Shore Alano Club in Pacific Beach. And I turned left. And I showed up at the Friday night gong show meeting in Pacific Beach, and some guy whose girlfriend had left him the day before scooped me up and wouldn't let me go all weekend, man. He was just like meeting after meeting. We went to like 18 meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous that weekend. He'd be driving to the next meeting. He'd be going, you got to go to meet. You got to read the book. You got to get a sponsor. Damn her. You got to go to meet. You got to read the book. Damn her. Like, I didn't know it, but I was getting a very early introduction to your typical AA relationship breakup is what I was getting. But I'm so very glad that that guy that night in his pain was somebody who had done the work of Alcoholics Anonymous, who had taken the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, and therefore understood that the solution to his pain that weekend was out of self, out of self, out of self. I got back to my ship after that weekend, and the one other sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous on my ship was waiting for me. His name was Bob W. He was 23 years old. He had 14 months of sobriety. I was 25 years old, and I had 48 days of sobriety when I got back to my ship. And Bob had a sponsor in port that had been hounding him for months to find somebody to work with, and so I was like gold being delivered to him on a silver platter. He was going to work with me whether I wanted him to or not. I was going to have to jump overboard to get away from this guy. My first 2 years of sobriety was spent on the USS Cushing traveling the world with Bob. Bob and I, whenever the ship would pull into port, wherever we were, whatever country we were in, we'd leave that ship. We'd go to a payphone. We had a number that we brought from San Diego. We'd dial that number. And maybe a live person from AA would answer. Maybe it would just be a recording. We'd get an address, and then we'd open up a map, and we would follow this map to an address, and you guys were always there. Whether there was 2 of you or 200 of you, you were always there. When the ship was out at sea, we'd be out at sea for 2 and 3 weeks at a time. The sponsor back in port had told Bob, you need to read the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous with him every single night when the ship is out at sea. So every night, Bob and I would meet in this little battery shop way down in the bottom of engine room number 2. And at 6:30, we would meet and we would read the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous back and forth to each other. And I got to tell you, in my mind's eye, when I picture those two young men out in the middle of the Pacific Ocean, down there in the bottom of engine room number 2 of the USS Cushing, two guys reading the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, I view it as Alcoholics Anonymous in its purest form. It was the blind leading the blind. Neither one of us knew what the hell we were doing, but we had a desire to stay sober. We had a big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and we had the fellowship when we could access it. And what's supposed to happen under those conditions happened. We both had a vital rearrangement of our attitudes and ideas towards life. You know, you guys are probably celebrating birthdays after this, and here in Southern California, you know, when you get 1 year, all your friends show up, and you get a cake, and we sing really badly to you, and, you know, but it's a big deal. Maybe even your family shows up, and oh, right? My 1 year happened on January 21st, 1988. I was in the middle of the Pacific Ocean, and Bob went and stole a stale piece of cornbread off the mess deck, came down to the engine room, and there was no candles on the ship, so he flicked a wood match, and he put it on there, and he sang happy birthday to you. And I blew out that match, and then Bob said, would you like to share? It was as lame as it sounds. It was just so lame. But something happened that later that night. In the middle of the night, I'm laying in my rack in the middle of the Pacific Ocean. And I remember I had this feeling of, you know, it's the only thing that I really know is true is that I got 1 year. I still had a lot of charges that I was dealing with the military. I still had charges in port in San Diego with the civilian authorities. My family would barely talk to me. I was still involved in an embezzlement scam that I forgot to talk about. It's the whole 8-step workshop that it would take for me to describe what was going on with that. I didn't know what was real, what not real, where my life was going to go, whether I was even going to be able to stay, or whether I was even going to be able to stay in the Navy. But I had 1 year. That's the only thing I could have put my hand on a Bible and swear, I've got 1 year sober. And on that night, I realized why I first noticed the way you guys would roll your sobriety day off your tongue like your children's birthday. You knew it like the back of your hand. And on that night, I realized why. Because it's the one thing we got no matter what. Nobody can take it from us. I also thought, maybe I can get a life like I hear those people when we're in port and at those meetings, that maybe I can get a life like they're talking about. Because people were talking about having a life that meant something, that had meaning and purpose. And I didn't even know, but maybe. 2 years sober, I got an honorable discharge out of the Navy. That is the result of the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, an apparently merciful God and a Navy clerk that lost half my file. The first thing I had ever accomplished in my whole life is that I got an honorable discharge with a solid DD-214, and those things follow you the rest of your life. And again, in that same 8-step workshop, if I ever did it, I can tell you exactly how my life changed because I did what Alcoholics Anonymous asked me to do and withstood all of the charges that were against me when I could have bailed, and I showed up and made amends on every single one of those things. And I didn't want to do it, and I faced jail time. I didn't want to, but everything rode on that, and I can pinpoint numerous turning points where my life, the way it is today, happened because of that, because of what you guys told me to do. I've only got a few minutes left. One of the amends I could not make while I was still in the Navy was that my parents had paid for a bachelor's degree. I didn't have one. Bob, who was also pretty new, he goes, I'm sure the right answer will come, but the grand sponsor got involved. And it's never good news when the grand sponsor gets involved in this stuff. And I was quickly informed that I had two choices. I either had to pay my parents back every single nickel they had wasted on that, or I had to go get what they paid for in the first place. And that's, I chose a university in this town called Covina. I'd never heard of this town called Covina. My plan was to just get my degree and go back to Seattle, and I have never left because I found something that had been missing. And it was brought up earlier, a home group. I had been a nomad in Alcoholics Anonymous around the world, just out of necessity, wasn't anybody's fault. But I had never, I could not have had one. Well, I guess Bob and I could have the home group, because home group is somewhere where if you don't show up, you'd be missed. Yeah, Bob would have gone, I'm alone here, right? Our little thing on the ship, right? But I pulled into the... it's called the 502 Club by nickname, San Gabriel Valley Alano Club, to a noon meeting when I pulled into Covina. And my idea was, I got to go to school, I got to work, I need to get a life, I'll stop by meetings when I get a chance. I've heard people in AA talk about having lives, I need one of those. And I pulled into just to see where the meeting hall was in case, for when I need a meeting. And that's when I met Eddie Cochran, and he was making coffee at that meeting. And he came up to me and he said, son, I've never seen you before, what you doing? And I had a really good answer. Sir, it's very nice to meet you. I'm 2 years sober. I'm fresh out of the United States Navy. I'm going to be going to the local university. I'm going to be working. You won't see me very often, but I'll stop by when I can. That's exactly what he did. He laughed. And then he delivered the Gettysburg Address to me. As a young man, it's the most important information I ever got. He said, son, school and work are wonderful things for you to do in between meetings. What he was really telling me is, son, you need to learn to live in Alcoholics Anonymous and visit the world. He was encouraging me, please, son, do not try to hash it out there in the real world and only visit us when convenient. It won't work. First thing he told me to do was put newcomers in my car. The car I had when I arrived in Covina, I like to call it my Rolls Canardly. It's a car that rolls down one hill and canardly make it up the next. There was a 68 Volkswagen with a hole in the floorboard that had to push start. First thing he said, put new guys in your car, your life will get better. I didn't see how that could possibly be, but he was 10 years sober when I was born, so I gave it a shot. And the very first night I followed this man's direction, my life got better. The new guys could push start my car. He didn't say how much better, he just said better. I got to tell you everything that I dreamed about on that 1 year when I was laying in my rack, about having a life of meaning and purpose, I found right here in Alcoholics Anonymous. I've been able to, by living in Alcoholics Anonymous and visiting the world, I've probably, after the Navy, I have traveled the world 5 to 6 times over. And I never dreamed that that could be true. But the real thing is that I found meaning and purpose. I didn't know that's what I was really looking for. That there's a reason for me to get out of bed. And I have found that that's where I find God. That's all he wants for me, is to have meaning and purpose in my life. Thanks for letting me share.